Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in this week for David Inge. Glad you could listen. During this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, practicing clinical physician, and this is your chance to call with any questions you have about women's health issues. We'll talk for a little bit about some of the things that the research is turning up, some trends that are going on out there, whatever it is that comes up in our conversation. But your issues are the most important thing. If you'd like to call with questions, you're welcome to do so. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you are listening, around Illinois, Indiana, wherever you are, 800-222-9455. At any point during our conversation, give us a call. The number, again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Troopin, good morning.
Good morning.
Or Suzanne. I always call you Suzanne.
That would be fine.
Okay, good. So, you mentioned a couple things right before we got started that you'd like to maybe
throw out. I've talked a little bit before about some of the research work that I've been involved with, and I thought I would spend a moment just talking about, in general, what drug trials are and what they aren't, because there's actually been quite a bit in the media about what goes on in research, and I think that most individuals don't understand what it takes to bring new medical procedures or new medical treatments to the market, how intense it really is. There's always the very early stage research, the basic science research, attempting, for instance, we've got new estrogens because we've been able to synthesize estrogens that in the laboratory by starting with plant bases that exactly mimic the ones that were so-called natural estrogens. The most commonly used was horse estrogen, but it's natural in some sense, not necessarily for the human female. And so what it takes to actually bring medications like that to the market, the FDA or our Food and Drug Administration mandates that drugs then go into a very rigorous phase 1, 2, and 3 testing. And then after medications have been in the market, there are even what's called phase 4 trials. And these phase 4 trials involve medications that are already approved, but then looking at some aspect that either we don't understand or we want to understand more thoroughly. And I've been involved in many of these studies. I think there are a lot of benefits. I always like to tell patients there are tremendous benefits in many cases from participating in a research trial because all your medication's paid for, all your testing is paid for. You typically even get access to tests that you might not ever get access to, even if you have pretty good insurance, either because the test isn't on the market or your insurance company hasn't authorized that test to be paid for by your insurance. So I always urge patients to consider being in research trials. There are extensive steps taken to protect patients' privacy, protect their rights as a subject, and all these trials are always overseen by what's called IRBs or Institutional Review Boards is what it stands for, and an IRB is usually a panel of various individuals from lay people to scientific people to physicians to even clergy of one denomination or another that reviews the procedures and the precautions that have been taken to protect all those research subject rights. So I think that we have an excellent system of research in the United States, and I think that one of the reasons our medical system has been so terrific is that we do have this tightly controlled process. And currently, the trials that I'm involved in, well, there are actually a number, but we have a new urinary tract infection study, and we're testing a new formulation of an already available medication, one that would be a shorter time sequence to take and easier to take. So any local listener has a urinary tract infection, I can see them for free. And we're just embarking on a new contraceptive study looking at the injectable contraception and contraceptive in a new formulation. So that's a 2-year contraceptive study. And I know many insurance plans don't cover contraception. So there's another example where if your insurance plan didn't cover contraception, it'd be even another reason to possibly consider it. And we're also embarking on another study in terms of the treatment of endometriosis. It's not that we don't have effective treatments for endometriosis. It's true they're not effective for all women. But with endometriosis treatment, some women are diagnosed in their teen years. And many of our treatments are really only recommended that you use them for 6 to 9 months. And typically, there's a period of time after you go off medication that you do well, but over time, women relapse. So we're trying to understand what treatments might be available that would be more suitable for very long-term therapy, literally years, if somebody was diagnosed that early in life. So we have a lot of exciting trials going on, and I'd be happy to take questions about research in general.
Okay, this might be somewhat of a naive question, but one thing that occurs to me, I've heard people sort of say this too, it's great to be involved in a clinical trial and you know, help out advance the frontiers of medicine and all this stuff, but what if you're in the control group? You know, and
well, not every trial has a control group.
Okay.
The early phase one trials do, and it's very tricky to establish. We had a trial last year. It was a hysterectomy trial, specifically on uterine fibroids. We weren't actually doing hysterectomies. We were trying to avoid hysterectomies, but to qualify, you needed to meet the same criteria that the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology recommends prior to having hysterectomy. So in other words, we were specifically looking for people who met the clinical criteria for hysterectomy. And in fact, there were 5 arms to that trial, and one was, in fact, a placebo arm. So here is a woman with a known gynecologic condition with the standard features of anybody's case that would generally be recommended to have a hysterectomy, but she was going to have to be willing to participate in a research trial. Now, one thing that happens even with the placebo arms is that we watch the patients very, very carefully.
Yeah.
And if they get into any danger situation, of course, they come off study. And that did have to happen across the country. What happens with many of these trials is no one physician necessarily has enough patients to complete a study of any type in a short enough time frame, so that we usually link together 20, 30 sites. I'm in one study right now where we're looking for healthy volunteers over the age of 50. We pay them $10 just to draw their blood, and we're specifically just giving blood anonymously to create a bank for other researchers, specifically researchers looking for genetic cancer links. There are 100 sites for this study across the United States, and I believe Canada as well. So, but at any rate, with the placebo arm, so you do have to be watched very closely. Now, this trial that I was talking about with the fibroids did conclude already. Well, patients are in their final stages, but we've closed enrollment. And now they'll be able to look at the information and move on to the next phase of testing, which would be only arms that actually have treatment in them. And for instance, all the different 3 studies that we are just starting now, the urinary tract infection, the contraception, and the endometriosis one, all those have both arms. The patients actually get medical treatment. And in fact, in a case like a urinary tract infection, even if you were in a study that had a placebo arm, you have cultures to determine whether or not your infection cleared up or not. And even if you get the study medication, if your infection doesn't clear up, we need to know that, and you need to be retreated.
So there's a lot of testing that goes along.
Absolutely. Yeah. And a little bit of paperwork.
A little
and
bit.
And that is why they generally pay participants, because it does take a little time. And time is so precious to most everyone.
Yeah. Amen to that. Who administers these? Is it National Institute of Health or...?
National Institute of Health administers many studies. I'm not currently working with any of those. the studies that I have going right now are typically administered by either a branch of a particular drug company or more typically an organization called a CRO. And those are contract research organizations, and they do oversee studies. That's their whole career and job, and they do a terrific job of it.
We're talking with Suzanne Troupin. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, practicing physician, and she's our guest once a month to talk about women's health issues. If you have questions not related to, well, doesn't matter what they're related to, actually.
Absolutely.
You are welcome to call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I had a question for you, and I know there are other topics that you brought with you, but I had a chance to speak recently with a researcher on eating disorders, and read this book that she wrote. The researcher is Joan Jacobs Brumberg, and it was a very, very powerful book, and it's something that I didn't know a lot about until that point. I still don't know a lot about it, but I happened to be speaking with a nurse practitioner locally and just mentioned that I, you know, had read this book and had she seen a lot of instances of eating disorders. And, of course, we're, you know, university community, a place where there are a lot of young affluent women, and eating disorders seem to affect young affluent women maybe almost exclusively or certainly primarily. And her reaction was, oh, yes, all the time. It is one of the most difficult things to deal with, and so we started a conversation, and it was something that obviously, you know, was of grave concern to her. And I guess I'm curious if there, you know, what is there recent research or anything on this topic that you know, might be worth talking about.
Well, in the past couple of decades, we've done a lot to identify what the disorders are, what some of their causes are. What are the specific nutritional deficiencies, and then what needs to be done to treat them? One of the disorders that was diagnosed that we see commonly is the athletic triad. So extremely athletic, trying to cut back on eating to stay sort of, I guess the quote would be lean and mean, but, you know, mostly muscle, no fat, and then getting so lean as to lose menstrual cycles altogether. So we know that there is a link in between having regular menstruation and having good nutrition. And we don't quite understand what the link is. In the very early days, we used to have an actual figure. They used to say most girls wouldn't menstruate till they reached at least 100 pounds, and then they wouldn't maintain menstruation unless they were about 22% body fat. Now, an average guy that has a lot of muscle, doesn't look like he has any fat, could be, in fact, between about 9 and 12% body fat. A real skinny runner, that's a girl, could get down that low, but isn't typically. Even a typically fashionable individual might have somewhere between, say, a 15 and 19% body fat. And that, I'm using fashionable in the very skinny model sense. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we've talked a lot about the other end of the spectrum, and we consider anything under 26% body fat heart healthy, with 29% and no risk factors, no smoking, no hypertension, no family history of risk factors, probably still heart healthy. And then there's the over 29% that's definitely not considered healthy. And in my practice, I see both spectrum ends of the eating spectrum. And unfortunately, I have many patients that are in the much higher than that range, so it's a little bit tough. We have a general feeling that we don't understand all the origins of the disorder, and I am personally very interested to see how the current patterns of eating and the current patterns of nutrition in the average individual play out in terms of nutritional deficiency to individuals who want to stay very thin, because we have a much higher fat diet than we really should have. Even this is what these young people are being exposed to when they're under 10 and when they're 10 to 15. We have a lot more inactivity than we ever had, so that body fat percentages are going up in general in the childhood population and in the adult population just because of being sedentary. And then to combine that, when you hit that point where you suddenly, perhaps a young individual wants to be extremely thin and confine herself to the look that she thinks that she needs to have based on what she's seeing in magazines and in television and so forth, you combine that and I think we get into real nutritional risk status. We see a lot of individuals that have very low potassiums and very low sodiums, and you can get into that state even if you're not eating or if you're bulimic and you're throwing up your food. And that can cause muscle weakness and fatigue, and overall fatigue can lead to depression. So then you get depression exacerbating these eating disorders. We still have too low a calcium intake in many of these young individuals with eating disorders, so they're not laying down all the bone that they really should be laying down. And we're going to see this as premature osteoporosis later on in life. And it's very, very difficult to talk to a teenager and say, well, I'm worried about your bones when you're 50 and 60. They just look at you like, what planet did you drop off of? Why would you worry about that? And so that's definitely a concern. I think there is a lot of misinformation about body fat distribution. There's abuse of certain medications, even male hormone abuse amongst certain groups, because they think that it will make their body fat be distributed differently. And in fact, used in the right dosage, it probably would. So there's that issue to contend with. But yes, there are many eating disorders, and I think a lot of the research right now strictly centers on a psychological approach, that what is the combination of psychological features that would set this up to begin with? Yeah. And I think that's where the research is going.
Are there particular nutritional strategies in terms of, different stages of a young woman's development that you would want to review?
Well, I think that everybody needs to learn about balanced eating. There's somewhat of a discrepancy about what balanced eating is. I think most of us think in terms of three meals a day. And in fact, it may be better to have five or six, quote unquote, meals. But if you switch five or six eating episodes into five or six actual meals, your calorie intake is going to be way up. I think that you have to make a fundamental decision about what approach you're going to take. There aren't too many young vegetarians, but there are some. And that you have to, if you're going to have a vegetarian approach to your eating, your nutritional food groups have to be filled, obviously, with different kinds of foods. I think that my biggest instruction to anybody who's approaching good nutrition is to try to work on portion control. We have this nice box of plastic food that we bring out as often as we can to show patients, here is what a potato should look like, and here is what 8 ounces of milk looks like, and so forth. And it's plastic, and they can look at it. And I think most people are shocked at what a so-called portion is. And they're eating a lot more and bigger portions of fat-containing food, and maybe not even having adequate portions of vegetables. And then there's the group deciding whether or not your diet should contain 15% fat, 20% fat, 30% fat. I don't think too many nutritional groups think that you should go too much higher than that, but there's no doubt that some of the actual diets out there have higher fat percentage than that because they're so heavily weighted into meat-type protein foods. And I think that portion control and then nutritional content, if somebody who is watching her weight or concerned about her weight is cutting out food portions or cutting out meals, you probably can replace some of that with some vitamin supplementation. And that's not going to add calories, and it may be something. There are even chewable vitamins out there now. So it may be something that with a very simple strategy that isn't going to add calories, you can add a lot of nutritional value.
We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's go on and include them in our conversation. First up, a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Can you tell me at what point you recommend bone scans or, you know, a more definitive osteoporosis kind of diagnosis?
Okay, that's a great question. And one of the problems is a lot of the national organizations, the National Osteoporosis Foundation, the World Health Organization, and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, none of these organizations have gotten together and pulled together what they think is a consistent plan like we have basically for pap smears. There are really three sets of tests that we use to detect osteoporosis. One is a type of urine test where it looks at a marker of bone turnover, and it tells us a couple of things. One, if you're in a very high bone turnover state, even if you don't test in an osteopenic, low bone, or osteoporotic range, you might be heading there faster than you think. So we use those urine tests. The other is the actual bone density. By definition, most organizations determine osteoporosis by your actual bone density. And when you get one of those tests, you get a T-score and a Z-score. And the Z-score is your age-matched control, and osteoporosis is defined on the T-score, which is your bone density compared to a younger individual. Even though we know, in fact, a 20-year-old and a 70-year-old can have the identical T-score, and in fact, the 70-year-old is still at more risk for her bones breaking or fracturing than the 20-year-old. So the scores aren't everything. And then finally, a piece that I tend to even leave out sometimes more than I should, but the final piece is an actual X-ray study to determine if fractures have occurred. Now, so those are our three sets of tests, and the issue is who do you use those tests on and when do you use them? Some groups advocate using these tests later in life, 65 and older, because you'll get the most bang for your buck. You'll get the most positive tests the older individuals you test. Other groups go to the side of at least age 40 because you will never pick up, if you wait till 65, you're never going to pick up those premature bone losers if you wait till 65. And I tend to go with 40. Now, if you have an individual that's very high at risk, who might this be? Somebody who's had a couple of fractures, somebody who has a very strong family history of osteoporosis, someone who had irregular periods, we were talking about eating disorders, somebody who had an eating disorder, someone who's had a very low calcium intake in their life, but it's not just calcium that we actually look at. We look at vitamin D and E and K as well as part of that. And those kinds of things, there are other risks. If you've taken glucocorticoids, a type of steroid, you might be at risk for premature osteoporosis. So individuals who might be at risk for premature osteoporosis, they may even need to be tested earlier. Even some individuals who are very young. There's with the Depo-Provera shot, there has been some research done worldwide, and there's a trial concluding in the United States, but it's not done yet, that indicates that if you're on a typical Depo-Provera contraceptive injection dose, that you have lower estrogen levels than you would naturally, and that some of those individuals might possibly be at risk for earlier bone loss, and maybe in those individuals, bone scans might be indicated. So it's not one of those kinds of questions that I can say, This is the recommendation for every person. It's one of those medical issues where a woman needs to decide that with her own physician, if she's seeing a nurse practitioner, whatever healthcare provider she's seeing, and weigh the risks and benefits and look at your insurance coverage, see what they cover. Some of these tests aren't very expensive. Peripheral bone testing on the finger, not as accurate as testing other sites. It's only $75. That's a very inexpensive test. And I think the urine tests are around in that range as well. So not terribly inexpensive and possibly very informative. And yet, as you get over 65, I think most physicians would agree that if you're going to do bone density testing, probably you should think about including the hip.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. We have a couple callers waiting. We're talking this morning with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. We have a couple of callers waiting to talk to, and we welcome others. Any questions you have about women's health issues are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Another listener in Champaign next on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you for taking my call today. I have a very serious acid reflux and a hiatal hernia, and we have tried to control it through medicine and diet, and that only works marginally well. But what is becoming a problem is that it gets much worse when I get my period, and even being on a very standard birth control pill doesn't seem to change the situation. So what could be the relationship between the change in hormones when you get your period and the possible switch in causing this acid reflux to kick in?
Off the top of my head, I treat a lot of patients with acid reflux, and just off the top of my head, I'm not sure that I've ever read of a known hormonal association with that condition. We know it's worse in pregnancy, but the whole GI transit time in pregnancy is slowed down, and the ovaries produce a hormone called relaxin, which relaxes the musculature, and it's thought that some of those issues and the really high levels of hormones in pregnancy would increase those conditions, and none of that should really apply to somebody cycling normally. One thing about birth control pills is that most typical birth control pills have a 3-week active cycle and a 1-week inactive cycle. But there's no reason that you couldn't have a 6 or a 9 or a 12-week long cycle and then only be off the pills for a shorter period of time. There are some pills that will be coming on the market in the next few years that are specifically designed that way. So one strategy I always say to try with birth control pills in any of these conditions where some individuals seem to have a worsening of a particular medical condition is instead of just taking the birth control pill for a few weeks, see if by extending that cycle you can't lessen the episodes, and that in and of itself may be a benefit. The other thing to consider is something like the injectable contraceptive, and one of the features of that is the hormone level is very, very even, and the estrogen levels are a little bit low. So if it is a response to fluctuating hormone levels, you'll get a much more even level than you would either naturally in a natural cycle or with the use of birth control pills in a typical fashion.
Is there any, having very serious acid reflux and having it not controlled by either diet or medicine, what are the long-term effects? What am I looking at down the road if this is a situation that continues? And this has been a problem for 5 years, and I'm in my 20s, so I'm looking at if this is not, if I can't control it, this is going to build up over the years.
Well, we're getting a little afar from my own personal mm-hmm. field. I know that there are surgical corrections, and it's probably would benefit you to see a surgeon and find out if your condition would be amenable to surgery. I know the surgical corrections don't have... it's not like a guaranteed fix, but they do have a certain success rate, and probably that would be your next best step.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, and good luck. We have another listener to speak with. This is someone in southeastern Illinois on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. I was wondering, you were talking about a research product on a urinary tract infection.
Yes.
Will the results of that be applicable to men as well as women? Or
is... It is a trial that is being done in men as well as women. I only see female patients, so I don't have too many men enrolled in my site. But other sites treat are urologists, and they primarily treat men, although they have some women patients as well. Yes.
This treatment, I assume it's a new medicine.
It's a new formulation of an antibiotic treatment. So the idea is to this particular branch that I'm in, although there are a couple other branches of the study that look at more serious infections, there's for what's called lower tract disease. Lower tract disease really means the bladder. Mm-hmm. Primarily, and one of the problems is that some antibiotic therapies aren't well tolerated or take a long time to kick in, and so we're looking at shorter treatment cycles that might possibly be as effective. And since most of us don't like taking medicine day in, day out for any length of time, the fewer pills we can take on the shorter times schedule is pretty much beneficial to everyone. But yes, men are in it.
So it is basically a variation of antibiotic treatment. I mean, it's
yes.
An antibiotic thing.
Yes.
One more question. I was just wondering, how in the world can you determine percentage of body fat? I mean, I could see where you could make a rough estimate, but down to...
That's a good question. Caught there. You can measure skin folds. You can measure height versus weight. Obviously, it's very, very rough, but there are tables that can do that. We think that some of the more accurate ways are what's called underwater weighing. And no, I don't have that in my office, but they do have that at the university, and the Department of Kinesiology uses that quite a bit. And then there are other, even more sophisticated ways that they try to specifically look at your metabolism and your body heat. And there's one little device that I do have that looks at electrical flow through your body, and it calculates you based on your height, your weight, and this electrical flow, it calculates your body fat percentage. And we have a little machine in the office that does that. They just hook you up to a couple electrodes, push a button, it's done. It's completely painless. And so there are a number of ways that we can determine that.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. We have about 20 minutes left with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, actually a little less than that. And if you'd like to ask any questions related to women's health issues, you're welcome to call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Just speaking of the body fat issue, is it a good idea to maybe even... aim for a certain percentage body fat given a particular lifestyle?
One number in any walk of medicine probably isn't the whole picture, but definitely a nutritionist or a physician, or in some places exercise gyms have consultations as well. And basically you want to look at your height, you want to look at your weight, you want to look at your overall fat distribution, and think a little bit in terms of your overall risk factors. If somebody has a very strong family history of early heart disease and early heart attacks, they would really be beneficial to be skinny. And I think in that context, you can figure out where you are body fat wise and approximately where you'd like to end up. Now, some people can achieve that body fat very easily. A little extra exercise, a little less eating, boom, they're there. Most of us struggle a little bit more than that. And we need to also remember that actually for every little niche you go down in terms of your body fat, you reduce your heart disease, so that there are many benefits, increased exercise, increased flexibility. Of course, there's some effects on increased longevity, but more importantly, there's decreased diabetes and decreased gallbladder disease, as well as the decreased risk in heart disease that I've mentioned. So we have quite a few benefits to be gained by even very small losses in weight. And I think that individuals who focus on this, I'm happy and I'm heavy and this is okay. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, that is absolutely true. But you can be a little bit less likely to even get cancers and to need medical tests or even to have a blood clot in your leg, so forth, if you lower your weight. So that with whatever strategy you're doing to gradually lower your weight, you're going to really improve your mm-hmm. health.
On the other hand, a personal trainer I spoke with recently, said, yeah, it's really important to be fit and reduce your body fat, but you need some fat to live.
Oh, absolutely.
Getting too carried away, because he sees this, I think.
Well, that's true. Fortunately, that's the minority. But yeah. You need some fat to metabolize. We talk a lot on, at least my show, on hormones. And hormones are made from the basic molecule cholesterol, which is a fat. And we can generate some in our liver, but we do need some fat precursors to be able to generate that. Most of our cell membranes are composed of fat, and the influx and outflux of chemicals in and out of cells are what make us live and breathe and think and our heartbeat. So there's no doubt about it. You do need some fat.
Our lines are all full, so let's go on and include as many people as we can. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
I have a question about your ability to change your cholesterol level with diet. About 15, 16 years ago, I read a long article in Atlantic Monthly that said some of the research wasn't bearing out the National Institutes of Health predictions on cholesterol and diet, and that they went on a big campaign and maybe the research was indicating that it was maybe not warranted. That was a while ago, and I'm just wondering, How can an individual make a big impact or not? Is genetic?
Well, you can. You're absolutely right. I remember that article, and I used to tell all my medical students to read it. And Atlantic Monthly does a great job in general on medical topics of sort of smashing some of our typical theories. There's no doubt about it. Some people with certain genetic predisposition, no matter how much they diet, or change their fat intake, their fat levels are going to stay at a particular place. And there have been several large studies, some involving the use of estrogen for women who are older, but many involving the use of the so-called statin drugs. There was the quote-unquote CARE trial that said that you can reduce your rate of heart disease and stroke by medication use. And there's no doubt about it. Couple things. One, a horrible diet, even with somebody with normal genetics, can probably increase your cholesterol over where you want it to be in your other blood lipids. Number two, it's not just cholesterol, it's other lipids. And I don't even remember myself that far back what the Atlantic Monthly article talked about, but we're now looking at lipoprotein A's, and a lot of people are running around with knowledge of their cholesterol, but not really knowledge of all their subfractions of fats. And if you really want to get sophisticated, you've got to look at those. Also, point number three, there are many other factors that contribute to your risk of having a heart attack or a stroke. And all those factors are too numerous for me to even go into, but would include the level of inflammation in your blood, the level of your B vitamin folic acid metabolism, so your level of homocysteine in your blood. So there are many, many factors. It's not just cholesterol, and it can't all be done with diet for everyone.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. We'll go on next to another listener in Muhammad on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, I have had in the past 5 years, since I'm now 70, both a full body scan, a bone scan, and the heel test, where you just put your heel in a bucket of water or something like that. The full body scan indicated I was normal, and the heel test indicated I was 0.04 off of being normal, whatever that meant. Is there any difference in these tests? Is one better than the other?
Well, there's no doubt about it. Some individuals lose bone at different places. And I'm not sure what you mean by a full body scan. Let me guess that actually what they were looking at is one spot in your hip and another spot in your lower spine. Actually, it's two different spots in the hip and three in the lower spine. And that probably wasn't a quote-unquote full body, because you probably need a very sophisticated type of CAT scan to do quote-unquote full body, and that's not usually being done. So you're probably absolutely right. Your heel may, in fact, be a little bit different than your lower spine and your hip.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Once again, we're talking with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. She joins us once a month to take your questions on women's health issues. We have about 10 minutes left and a couple callers. I'm sure we'll be able to get them in. And I'll mention the phone numbers again. If we have time, we'll take whatever questions we can. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Charleston on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'm 57, and I've been on hormones for about 20 years. I wanted to get off of them, so my doctor put me on Fosamax. I have a family history of osteoporosis, and I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Fosamax is an excellent drug. It's a bisphosphonate. It can be taken once a day, or there's a newly approved medication dosage that can be taken only once a week that most of my patients are switching over to. And it probably, in actuality for bones, has a more potent effect on bones than even maintaining on the estrogen. However, it only treats the condition osteoporosis. And if you want to treat things like vaginal atrophy and a few of the other things that estrogens were probably treating, as you get older, you may want to think in terms of other medications or additions to Fosamax therapy. You're still young. 57 is young, and you have some time before some of these other conditions become paramount to watch the literature.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. And we have another listener on line number 3 from the Chicago Western Suburbs. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Doctor, my father had Paget's disease. He died around when he was 86 years of age. And his sister, who actually lived in Europe, had a severe case of osteoporosis. I had a full body scan, which is like laying on the a table and having like a half circle covering over your body. That's what they call the full body bone scan. And they said I had some osteoporosis. I'm 66 years of age. What could I do to counteract these things?
Well, I think that you may want to see a specialist and get a full evaluation. You would want them to specifically look at your current skeleton, see if you're showing any signs of skeletal defects. You might want to consider any x-rays to see if you've already developed any spinal fractures that cannot be detected even by a full body scan. You'd have to look at fractures. And if you happen to consult with either an endocrinologist or an internist or a board certified obstetrician gynecologist that's familiar with these tests, you might also want to consider a urinary screen to see of your markers of bone turnover. Then you can stand back, look at all the information, see where you sit, and compare the different kinds of options. There are hormonal treatments, primarily estrogen, but there's some data that certain types of progesterone might even give additional benefit to adding in estrogen.
What could you do with your diet? I'm not big on taking medications.
You can get at least 1,500 milligrams of calcium in a day. You can get at least 400. Some might even say for high-risk individuals, 800 units of vitamin D in a day. And yet, most researchers would tell you that if you don't do something in addition chemically, that your body will not have that chemical signal to take the calcium from your system and put it into your bone. And you need something to give that signal to your bone.
Well, yeah, I'm for vitamins. But when you take calcium, are you supposed to take something else with it? And what are the percentages?
Well, the best calciums to take actually contain some vitamin D. And it's not necessarily percentage. You want to get a total amount in your diet per day. But still, you need to talk. You need to have individual consultation because
right.
if you don't take any kind of medication, either the bisphosphonates, Fosamax 1, bedactinol is another one, or the calcitonin, it's another kind of bone hormone that you can sniff, you can be put on fluoride if you're not comfortable with other kinds of treatments. And then there are the estrogens and designer estrogens I started to mention.
No, I won't take any estrogen. What about magnesium? I thought you're supposed to take calcium and magnesium together and vitamin D, but I don't know what the percentages are of the calcium and magnesium.
It's very unusual for an American to have a worrisome level of magnesium intake. Magnesium,
well, my
so
mother
you...
and father were from Europe.
I know, but I'm talking about our current diet in the United States
mm-hmm.
tends to have enough magnesium in it. And off the top of my head, I don't know the exact magnesium level to tell you, but I do know that most nutritional analysis says that we have enough magnesium in our diets.
Well, what causes the calcium not to go back into the bones? You know, say you're eating things with calcium, but it doesn't go into the bones, so your body is not absorbing this. Why is that, and what can be done?
Well, we think that it's related to the aging process and the levels of parathyroid in our bone and the low levels of natural hormones circulating in our system once we go through menopause. And we think that, in fact, our system works perfectly well through the 20s, 30s, 40s, which is about all we used to live in cave times. But we think that there's a part of the aging process that our body then, on the average, not everybody, but it sounds like in a family situation like yours, gets to the point where it needs outside help to get that calcium into the bone.
And weights would be good too, wouldn't it?
Weight-bearing exercise helps, but again, without something, the bisphosphonates or a hormone of some type or even fluoride does work and is available, it is not going to be probably enough benefit for most individuals.
Well, we're just about at the point where we're going to have to stop. There's one question I had that related to something that the listener mentioned, or you mentioned, actually, and that is the benefit of getting an X-ray in case there are fractures that were undetected. Are many of those asymptomatic that people don't even recognize for a while?
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes you can recognize by just looking at the curvature of the spine. Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount of spine curvature that occurs over time that would not be natural unless there are some minor either wedge shape or compression shape fractures that have occurred. But even bone density tests, one of the fallacies of bone density tests, if you have a lot of fractures and pack a lot of bone into a small segment, you could actually test normal in a lower spine and have it be completely osteoporotic. So I think we have to not put too much confidence in one little number or one little test. That's true in most of medicine.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to stop there since we're at the end of our time. Our guest has been Dr. Suzanne Troopen, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. And Suzanne, thanks once again for being with us.
Thank you.
We are broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, the home of WILL AM, FM, and TV, made possible by a gift from Alice and Robert Campbell. Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. And the staff at the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.